The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Our aim is to explore the fringe, lost civilizations, alternative science, the paranormal, and much more. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live or future guests via email or the live chat room. And remember to subscribe to us on iTunes. And now welcome to this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go?
And I'm your host, Soraya, as always. And we have something special for you tonight. But before we get to that, I want to say we are still collecting stories on people's unusual paranormal type of experiences. So if you have experienced anything and you'd like to talk about it, it can be anonymous. If you're local, we can do it in person. If you're not, we can do it over the phone. I think it's good for people to share their stories. And you can find our first one on our YouTube page if you go to wheredidtheroadgo.com. And, yeah, so if you have something you want to share, get in touch with us. Just go to the webpage, and there's a form to there's an email address and a way to contact us. You can also write us on Facebook, and you can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube, and all kinds of stuff. All right. So tonight on Where Did the Road Go, I'm going to pronounce a lot of things really wrong. We're going to be talking with Avery Morrow and his book, The Sacred Science of Ancient Japan, Lost Chronicles of the Age of the Gods. You with us there, Avery?
Yeah, I am. It's great to be on the show.
All right. And this is something that I am not, I mean, I've heard of this stuff before. These are what you call para-histories.
That's right. And that's a term I coined because this is a genre of literature in Japan. It's more than just one text, you know, like we might have the Necronomicon in English, or as we mentioned before the show, or you might have like the Book of Mormon trying to tell some kind of history that is radically different from the accepted story of the history of a nation. But in Japan, there are several of these texts. There are actually over a dozen of them. And so I felt like I really had to put some of these together into a book. And I've tried to explain them and why they're so unusual, and yet why they're so appealing in another sense.
And I like I said, I was aware these existed, but I don't think I've ever really read anything about them. I've seen references to them on rare occasions. I believe like Ancient Aliens referenced them at some point because of the UFO connection, but I've never delved into it, and they're utterly fascinating. Now, how did you get interested in this stuff?
Well, I started out by being interested in Japanese ancient history, and I just wanted to like read everything I could. Like, what was the earliest book written in Japanese? And I went and looked it up. And I found the familiar books that if people are interested in this topic, they're probably going to read the books called Kojiki and Nihon Shoki. And those are written in sort of classical Chinese or pidgin, and they're full of mythology. They're full of stories of the early emperors. And that is where most people's journey ends. But I found a mention of another text. And the person who was pushing this was saying, look, this is the real story of what life was like in ancient Japan. But the mainstream historians don't accept this. They're trying to, you know, basically pretend it's not there. And I started looking into it, and I discovered this is a really, really fascinating document. That is the Hotsumitsu Dai. That's chapter 3 of my book. And from there, I learned that that was not the only document like that. There are actually several others, and so my scope of research dramatically expanded after that.
Okay, and were you just fascinated with Japan in general all your life, or?
Yeah, I've been interested in Japanese culture since I was a kid. I lived in a Buddhist monastery in Japan for a little bit, but I felt like I had learned everything I wanted to know about Buddhism, and I started looking into Shinto, and all of these texts are related to Shinto in some vague way, although people wouldn't call them mainstream by any means.
Right, and there are a lot of people who think these are completely fake.
Yeah, and on the historical side, I wouldn't say, like, oh, we should rewrite Japanese history books and put these texts into there. But on the other hand, what the books are actually about is it's more than just history. It's a very it's a very spiritual narrative. That's why I called the book The Sacred Science of Ancient Japan. They have sacred geometry. They have metaphysical teachings, and it's often really fascinating stuff that are in these texts. And it really gives a new idea of what we think of as history.
Yeah, and what is the official history of, like, what is the accepted history in Japan? How far it goes back and such?
Yeah, I've put this all in chapter one, but I think that's a good thing to review. So we know that in Japan, people have been living there since the Paleolithic period. And in around the second century AD, a Chinese guy went over there to see what kind of society was being built up, and he found a priestess queen who was ruling over all of these tribes, who called Himiko, and that is the first record we have of a place in Japan. And it's interesting that most of the parahistories do not have any connection to that Himiko story. Most of them are connected to those first books that I mentioned that are talking about, gods descending from heavens down into earth, and of like multiple tribes being descended from the gods, and of this like line of emperors that goes back to the beginning of the creation of the world. And it's all different takes on those stories that are the basis for many of the figures, the gods or divinities or ancient people enshrined in Japan's Shinto shrines.
Okay. And so these para-histories, what these go back, in some cases, millions of years.
That's right. So there are some documents that say they were written around, like, 100 AD. But there are other documents, most notably the very interesting story of the Takenouchi documents, that claim that Jesus came to Japan and everything. Those documents are supposed to record histories going back millions of years.
Okay. And, I get one of the things you deal with a lot is the concept, I don't know if I'm saying it right, but the kami?
K-A-M-I? Yeah.
And what are
K-A-M-I.
These?
K-A-M-I, yeah.
How was it said?
Kami, that's right. You got
okay.
it right.
Yeah. Oh. Wow. All right. Do you want to explain?
Good. You're batting 1,000.
And these are spread through not just the para-histories, but the official history somewhat too, right?
That's right. So Japan's official histories begin with these kami. And kami, it's usually translated as like spirit or divinity or god. It also, you can read those two, that word kami as just meaning above. So it could just mean like a great person from a very long time ago. That's the way that some of these documents interpret it. Well, the kami weren't from, another realm. They were just great ancient heroes who set the whole system of government in order or something like that. But the important thing to know is that these kami are now enshrined in these, these Shinto kind of like pagan buildings that are, these shrines are found all throughout the country. There are over 10,000 of them, and many of them don't link into the official history. So it's a kind of mystery in Japan. Like, where do these shrines come from? You can go back as far as you want in written text, and they've basically always been there. So, these documents kind of they tell a story of filling in all of these gaps that have been excluded as the official history was like refined and rewritten over time.
And I see some connections here too. Like, one of the kami stories talks about eating food in the underworld and not being able to leave, which is something you see in mythology in other parts of the world as well.
Right. When I first read that, I was in high school, and I was so surprised. I was like, I've read about that in ancient Greece, and I've looked into that a lot. It seems like, if there is a connection there, it goes back much, much, much farther than any sort of history that, like, archaeologists or historians are able to uncover. So it's really cool how we can make these connections between, different mythologies on opposite sides of the world.
Okay, and this is where I'm going to probably start mispronouncing things. The Kujiki? texts.
Hey, got it again. Excellent.
It was luck. It looks like it sounds. And these,
yeah, the Kujiki is where the story starts to, you know, get away from that official story, because there is this document called the Kujiki. The short version is known to be over 1,000 years old, but it was never included in these official histories, at least not in recent times. They just said, oh, this is a forgery, blah, blah, blah. But these days, just academics in the West are starting to question that, saying, was this really a forgery, or was it just a alternative history that included stuff about other families that, you know, were not the imperial family, and they didn't really want to hear about those other families too much.
Okay, and they're broken. There's different versions of this. I believe you have a 10, a 30, a 31, a 38, and a 72. Is that right?
Yeah. So then this document, this so-called forgery that might really be ancient, someone put out an expanded version. I can't think of any, they're always putting out expanded versions of movies and stuff. I can't think if there are any books that come out like that. But
yeah, I don't know.
Right, but this was a book that came out that way. There's a Buddhist, a Zen monk said that he had discovered all of these extra volumes. In fact, 62 extra volumes, and that like this is like all sorts of secret teachings and stuff, and a prophecy for the future, and rules of medicine of how to heal yourself without having to make concoctions or anything, and all of this stuff. That is part of a history, I guess. But it's definitely, we've gotten far away from history by this point.
And when did the Kujiki come about? When was that supposedly written?
So the original short one was supposedly written 600 to 900, something like that.
Okay.
But this expanded one, we first hear about that in the early modern period. It was supposedly, it's just the same book. It was just a lot longer, mm-hmm.
Now, it was supposedly written in 600 to 900. When did it actually come to light?
It first came out in 1670, and when it did, that, it was just a history book, but the government got really upset about that. They said, no, we already have a perfectly good history book here. It tells how, the emperor came into power and why everything is good the way it is. We don't need this new book. This is obviously, someone has just made this up. And so they, they burned up the book. They destroyed the wood blocks that they used to print it. And they sent the people who published it into exile. That's where things start going, this is where we start going into a really underground kind of world, because it's clear that if you tell a different story than the official history, then people are going to get concerned, and people in high positions of authority are going to get worried.
And of the ones you cover, this is probably the most a fantastic of the books.
Right. Yeah. That's the funny thing. It's the first one that came out, and it really doesn't go that far away from the official history. It adds a lot of detail. It adds a lot of other things that you don't usually find in histories. And when that one gets burned up and sent away, then these other even more radical documents start coming out.
And what is the evidence for and against that one for being like official or real versus being a forgery?
The most interesting thing about that document is this 47 syllable song that has like all of the syllables of Japanese in it, kakiku keiko and so forth, and that is used in esoteric Shinto today to do a kind of meditation. It's meant to be able to summon the kami to, enter into your body and possess you. So it's supposed to be a very powerful incantation, and you have to wonder, how did it get into that book? And so I outline in my book how there are various theories about this, and some people say that this is proof that this big book wasn't just made up by some Zen monk. It's much too long to be made up by one guy anyway. But it must have had some ancient, like, esoteric or secret sources that he was publicizing for the first time.
Hmm. So do you think it's something that they compiled from maybe a bunch of other texts?
Yeah, I think that is the most likely thing. And in fact, this is the one text that has been studied by historians in Japan. And they kind of agree with that, although it's really hard to say, just because so much of it is completely new, like no one had ever seen that before. But it looks like it had earlier sources. And when you start digging into that, what could those earlier sources have been? That's when we start getting into the really crazy stuff.
Okay, and this in particular has some connection to the shrines around Japan, right?
Right, right. Actually, most of these books have connections in that, you know, you'll find this shrine that's dedicated to some kami, and you don't really know who was that kami, what was their role in history, why were they so important that someone built this, you know, this house for them to live in. And most, you know, some of those figures are in the official histories, but some of them aren't. So in this first book, the Kujiki, there are some explanations for stuff like that. In the second book, the Hotsumotsutai, there are even more.
Okay, all right. And now, these shrines, you talk about this in the book, and I found this really interesting. They're not really devoted to a particular religion, are they?
That's right. That's an important thing to know, is that the original purpose of shrines was local. And there was nobody controlling what they were allowed to say or do. So they could have their own dances, they could have their own ceremonies, and there was nobody like overseeing that or telling them to stop doing that.
And you also say religion was a term that wasn't even introduced until, what, the 1800s?
That's right, yeah. And I've actually been researching this recently over at the libraries here in Boston. In the medieval Japan, they really were only thinking about Buddhism. Like, Buddhism was the way to send off the dead samurai, and there were a lot of people dying in war and famine. So Buddhism was the only thing they would think about, and they did not compare it to whatever other stuff was going on in the country. So that gave shrines a lot of freedom, actually, and it was only later that they started looking at all of these shrine practices and saying, this is such a mess, like everyone's doing their own different little thing, we need to, you know, we just start standardizing this. So it took a long time for them to even think of the concept of a religion.
And you said some of this was also imposed by the U.S., wasn't it?
That's right. So after they had finished reforming shrines, they said, we've completely stamped out any sort of like sectarianism or preaching or anything like that. These aren't even religious buildings anymore. They're just, you know, they're basically historical sites. And that was the policy up until the 20th century, when the Americans came in and said, oh, look, they've been taking their religion and promoting it as if it were not religion, so we're going to make it religion again, which wasn't really in the first place.
So these were kind of spiritual centers that people could go no matter what they believed.
That's right. It was for the whole town, basically. You had this shrine, and I made the comparison to Halloween in my book. Like, everyone participates in Halloween, right? It doesn't necessarily mean that you believe in anything. It doesn't mean your belief you're trying to ward off evil spirits or anything like that. It's a community event, and it gets everyone closer together. And that's the sort of thing that would happen at shrines in medieval Japan.
Okay, now there's a political outlook to a lot of these para-histories. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, it's interesting, the image that these different books present of the emperor. That seems to be the one shared thing throughout all of these books. And, you know, in the Kujiki, it's pretty mild. But in the Hotsumotsutai, the second book I talk about, You have the emperor being like a role model for the whole country, and he has the job of teaching people about, you know, things as simple as the, you know, this system of months and years, or like how to structure a society, and it's all emanating from this one source. And in the Takenouchi documents, that gets even it goes into a global scale, that one.
Yeah, not all of these happen in Japan. Some of them do have a worldwide basis to them.
That's right. Especially these more recent ones that I talk about in the second half of my book, the Takenouchi documents, they have this idea that like all of the continents had been divided up among these local kings who were all being ruled over by a world emperor. And the emperor could, you know, live for millions of years, and he had a spaceship that he could use to fly around and visit all of the different continents. And so that is a very, very radical departure from these early documents.
Okay. And so let's look at the next book you cover, which is, I'm not going to try and say it. It's the one that starts with H-O-T.
Yeah, Hotsumatsutai. That's right.
Now, where did this come from?
It's not really clear where that one came from. All we know is that there was a guy who was living out by himself in the middle of the countryside and said that he had been given this book from his, I think it was his stepfather or something like that, and wanted to present it to everyone because he had found some secret history. And that is a really difficult thing to believe, that this guy had just been like sitting in his house, like writing, making up a document for 30 years or something like that. Because what we're talking about here is not just, you know, like a genealogy or something like that. This is an epic poem, is what the Hotsumatsutai is. It's over 10,000 lines long. And it's written entirely in ancient Japanese, not the Japanese that was like contemporary at that time, but ancient Japanese. It's all like a haiku going 7-5, 7-5, 7, except all the way down for 10,000 lines.
And the subject matter of this is what? It's a little more fantastic than the Kijiki.
Yeah, it what it talks about is in ancient Japan that had all sorts of technologies, like they were able to make writing, they I guess had the military technology to go all over East Asia, and it had a much more like simple and like clean government that was uniting the whole region, and it had a some sort of life extension or immortality herb that grew on Mount Fuji, I think it was, and that allowed some people to live for thousands of years.
And you compare that to myths in other cultures as well.
Yeah, there are a lot of things in this epic poem that are parallel to, like, you know, mythology of other cultures, stuff that they could not have known about in the Japan of that period. And that, yeah, I find there are, like, a lot of fascinating things about the Hotsumatsutai, and yet it's gotten no attention at all, which is really a shock. You know, like, there's no epic poetry in Japan. They don't have that tradition at all, and this is a very unusual document. I feel like people really ought to be looking into this.
And do you think there's any genuineness to this?
That is a really hard thing. I feel like you'd really have to talk to someone who is an expert in medieval Japan and would be able to tell the difference between like medieval Japanese and old Japanese, because I find people defend this very well. I haven't found people like, you know, responding to that, and you know, there's a very persuasive case that like the language being used in this text is like a real, you know, real ancient poetry. But I'm going to stay on the fence for the time being. Like it's really such an amazing proposition that this epic poem could have been preserved secretly for thousands of years. And yet that's what shrines are for, basically. These shrines throughout the country, they often have a place where you just keep ancient artifacts and documents, and the local people basically entrust the shrine with those treasures.
Okay, well, that one also speaks of reincarnation, doesn't it?
That's right. So we have this lord Amaterasu, who corresponds to Amaterasu in the standard mythology, and he goes to this school somewhere in the north. And at this school, he learns from his teacher about the reality of reincarnation, and how this needs to be the basis for any sort of government he's going to set up down in the Kyoto area.
Okay. I think it's the next one you did is the Hitsuki Shinji text. Is that right?
Yeah. That's what I was presenting on. At the esoteric conference at Colgate University last week. The Shinji is a text from the 20th century, and it's not a history book at all. It's just, it came about in a completely different way. This Shinto priest, he put his hand to paper, and his hand suddenly started writing on its own, and produced this large book that's many, many chapters long, and it talks about it has this message of a conspiracy that there's this ruling class who is currently dominating the world, manipulating people, and that the people with the true spirit need to assemble in Japan and gather together basically to do the work of God, and then there'll be an apocalypse, but it's going to lead to good things afterwards.
Now, this is the one that talks about Japanese people and such, that they're not necessarily born in Japan. It's more of a soul thing. Is that the one?
Yeah, that is a real surprise to me. I have not seen that in any other Japanese text. So the Hitsuki Shinji has this message that this is a message for the people of Japan, for Nihon, but what it means by Japan is not people who were born in that country. It means people who are willing to do the work of the kami, of the ancient gods, and those people could be born anywhere in the world. And in fact, it says there are people born in Japan who are not actually Japanese. They aren't of this nation of Nihon in the language it wants to use. And then there are people born in other countries who do have a heart of kami. And so it's kind of giving a radically new idea of what it means to be Japanese and what it means, to live in the land of the gods.
Okay. And so, I mean, an automatic writing text obviously has no set history, but it's almost like it's fascinating stuff regardless of the fact that the way it came about.
Yeah, and it has links to these parahistories in some way. The parahistories talk about many esoteric topics. There's a lot of symbolism and unusual stuff in there, and the Hitsuki Shinji also seems to reference those things. So the book that I've written here, it's a lot of different stuff at once, but it might be helpful in the future if I'm going to talk about the Hitsuki Shinji.
All right. Okay. We got to take a quick break. We'll be back in about a minute with Avery Morrow.
All right.
The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live guests via email or the live chat room. You can also check out our upcoming schedule, blog, link section, book reviews, videos, and links to our Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, and much more. That's wheredidtheroadgo.com.
And as always, I am your host, Soraya, and we've been talking tonight with Avery Morrow. His book, The Sacred Science of Ancient Japan, Lost Chronicles of the Age of the Gods. And I really enjoyed this book. I thought it was really fascinating. It was a lot of stuff I did not know anything about. And that's great. I'm so invested in so much of the stuff that we talk about that it's rare that I come across something so completely new to me. So, and the book is very well written, and it's not super long, but you have a lot packed in there.
Yeah, there's a lot to cover, and I really just feel like this is an introduction. I'm trying to, you know, get some new ideas out there and show people that Japan really does have a very rich esoteric world, because a lot of these documents are still being talked about today.
Okay. Let's go on to one of the more fantastic ones, and I'm not going to try and pronounce it. It starts with take.
Yeah, the Takenouchi documents. That's a lot of fun to write.
That's what I was going to call it.
That this is the document you've probably seen on, you know, a show like Ancient Aliens or something like that.
I think so.
Because it contains in it the story that Jesus, when he was from, like, what was it, ages like 12 to 33, he had gone missing. He was actually walking to Japan, and there, when he was in Japan, he studied ninja techniques, which he was able to take back to Israel and then, like, you know, surprise people by walking on water and doing stuff like that.
And saying ninja Jesus just sounds like, you know, one of those over-the-top sort of B-movies.
right. But, you know, I'm not sure how many people actually believe this in Japan, but there is a town up in the north of Japan that claims to have Jesus' grave. That, like, you know, Jesus, in the Takenouchi documents, he was not crucified, and he went and walked around the whole world spreading a message of love, and finally returned to Japan, and then his gravesite is there. And you can go see that in the north of Japan. It's next to the northern island, and they have a big cross there, and they have all of these kind of, like, eerie occult symbols that had been found in the local shrines and stuff like that. And it's definitely a thing.
Now, what's the official explanation for that place, for that grave?
That's a good question. Like, you know, it's part of the promotion for the little village where that grave is, because, like, there's really not a lot else out there it's a very, like, you know, snowy, cold place. So they definitely do not question the story. They just, like, you know, whether you believe this or not, come out and see the grave of Jesus. But it's kind of odd, you know, like, nobody had ever heard of this before the 20th century. It was rediscovered by the people who were researching these documents.
And now the Takenouchi documents, where did those come from?
That is another really, really fascinating story. There was this guy named Takeuchi, who was already known, like, he was like published and everything, that he was some kind of like esoteric ascetic. He was living at a Buddhist temple. He was doing, like, meditation, like standing under a waterfall, and that sort of, like, tough life. And then in 1928, he said he decided to show the world that these documents that he had inherited from his father, which were not written in regular Japanese. They were written in all of these elaborate ancient scripts that he said had come from the age of the gods.
Okay. And the evidence for and against this being having any kind of genuineness to it?
Well, the way I put it in my book is that this is a text that appeared when Japan really was trying to, like, face the world, and you know, like, the West had come in with Christianity, and they were aware of all sorts of other religions around the world, and so people had to wonder, what is the Japanese religion? And the Takenouchi documents kind of fill that void. They say that really all of the religions in the world have a single source, and that source is in Japan.
And of course, there are legends of Jesus going to India as well.
Right. That's definitely, you know, that's a coincidence. That's not like they copied that or anything. So it's definitely a very interesting coincidence that you have some people at that around that same time saying that Jesus went to India, and then other people saying, no, he kept on going after India and just kept walking all the way to Japan.
But where he became a ninja.
Right. But the other surprising parallel is that in Europe at that time, there was this guy who had, actually it was America too, a guy had published a book in America claiming that he had just traveled to Mongolia during the Russian Revolution, and he had heard legends there about the king of the world who now lived, like, underneath the earth, like, awaiting the day when he would return. And the Japanese people didn't know anything about this, you know, weird story, but at the same time in Japan, there appeared a similar story that there's this, you know, king of the world living, who lived millions of years ago, and that he was now, you know, concealed, and that, like, you know, Japan had been sealed off from its former position as the center of all the world religions.
Hmm. Okay, and it's not just Jesus; it's Moses too that's in these documents.
Right, it's everyone actually. You know, Moses, Muhammad, Confucius, Lao Tzu. They all came over to Japan and learned the techniques for the one single tradition that is the basis of all the world religions.
All right, and now this document also talks about, like, gives sort of a general feel of the same stories from Atlantis, Mu, Lemuria, that there was an advanced culture that was destroyed, doesn't it?
Yeah, so in this book, the technology is much more apparent. Like, you know, you've got flying ships. The ancient, you know, the creator of the universe descended down to the earth in a flying ship. And you have, like, writing technology and medicine and all of these things were being invented in ancient times and were then slowly forgotten over the millennia as like, you know, people were basically just unable to keep perpetuating all these technologies. And eventually everything went to ruin. Atlantis sunk because, you know, not Atlantis, but the continent sunk in the ocean is what the text says. And then they had to shut down their whole empire.
Okay, and what about pyramids? This is also connected into this, isn't it?
Yeah, the people who researched these documents, they had also, like, you know, they were adventurers and hikers, and one of these guys was hiking through the woods in Japan and spotted a mountain that he said looked just like a pyramid. And he was able to, you know, identify rocks that he thought had been formed by humans. And once again, this was the kind of book that the authorities thought was going to, like, confuse people and subvert the established history. And so that book was banned, the book about pyramids in Japan. Very hard to find today.
I mean, and you see that anyway. People pick up natural hills. I mean, a lot of people say the Bosnian pyramid is just a natural hill, but they're trying to prove it's not, and so on and so forth. Did anyone ever research this to see if there was any real evidence that it was a pyramid?
Yeah, I was trying to look up pictures of that mountain myself. It was kind of hard to tell, right? It's the same thing with that Balkan pyramid, right? It's kind of like, yeah, you could say it looks like a pyramid, but it's all covered in grass and dirt. So
yeah.
You really can't judge that until you excavate it, which is, I think, what that guy is trying to do now.
Yeah. The Bosnian pyramid's been somewhat excavated, but a lot of experts and even some of the alternative experts, like Robert Schock, have said it's a natural formation with some caves around it.
Yeah, and there's no one doing that in Japan, as far as I know.
Hmm.
But there definitely are people who are trying to map out all of these pyramids these days and figure out, like, you know, which ones are more authentic. Does it mean anything and stuff like that?
Yeah. And the flying ships, do these have any similarity to the tales in, like, the Mahabharata and stuff about Vimyanas?
Huh, I just read the Mahabharata and I did not see those flying ships.
Really? I thought the Vimyanas were in the Mahabharata.
Ah, man, I totally missed out.
Or maybe it's in one of the other texts. I know they talk about the Vimyanas somewhere. They have a whole book, ancient text, about how to make them.
Wow. No, I don't think that one was available in East Asia when you know, to compare to this stuff. But definitely, it's part of the official history. It's part of the earliest Japanese history is that the original inhabitants of Japan came down from the heavens in a flying ship. And that this was one of the proofs that they used that they were, like, the original inhabitants of the island and not just people who moved in.
Yeah, and I think that's what ancient aliens picked up on is the
right. They could totally hop onto that, right?
All right. Yeah. So let's move on to the fourth one, which is the Katakamuna.
That's right. There you go.
All right.
No need to be afraid of pronouncing Japanese.
This one's really fascinating to me. You want to get into a little bit about what it is?
Yeah, that one, I don't know, like, the whole story of how it came to be is really something that I'd like to devote a lot of time to, and that one's kind of difficult. But I think the important thing is that what it's supposed to be is a text that came down from, like, you know, prehistoric, like, hunter-gatherer times, but it's talking about some kind of science. And I think what he calls it is experiential science. It's not something that you do by, you know, getting rid of all of the impurities and taking measurements in a laboratory and trying to, you know, ensure that everything is just right so that you'll identify the true cause of something. But no, this is meant to be a very different type of science. Science, of course, is, you know, just means knowledge,
right,
in Latin. And so this is describing a type of knowledge that you get from experiencing the world around you. And the way it is described in these documents is but through a very, very symbolic language where every word can be broken down into multiple levels of meaning. And so oftentimes, what this document is for people who read it is this sort of meditative experience where you look at these words and then you're able to break them down and see the meaning embedded in every syllable of the language. And, you know, through doing that, they feel like, you know, this is definitely experience of what it must have been like to, I don't know, to like speak language in ancient Japan or something like that. But it has a view of the universe where the most important force is not the scientific energy, but of like creativity and how new things come into being. And so this is caused by interaction between the material world and the higher world.
And it's also called the Eight Mirrored Script. Am I right on that?
Right. The script that this is written in is also very, very unusual. It's written, made entirely of like circles and lines and like crosses through the circles, and it's not written like left to right like you would write English, but it starts in the middle of the page where they put this this single central symbol, and then it spirals out of the page, and so the way to read the poem, because it's always a poem, it's like a haiku, 575, is to start in the middle and then go outward and outward, and you can just imagine it spiraling outward towards infinity.
And nothing, there's no other writing like this, is there?
Yeah, I looked long and hard, and as far as I could tell, this is the, you know, the only text of its kind, like the only script of its kind that's written in a spiral like this. I actually tried to publish that in a history journal, and they said, "Prove it." And it was not, it's like, you can't really prove a negative like that. But I am pretty sure this is a unique thing in the world.
Now, how old is this supposed to be?
It's not really given. Like it's meant to be thousands of years old, basically before there was any sort of, you know, history or like material civilization in Japan. But there were still people living there for sure, and so they just imagined them as the sort of Paleolithic people, right, who were writing this.
Okay. This thing is a lot more mystical. And it deals with sort of a mystical type of physics, right?
Right. And I think that it's very interesting because a lot of the writing about this one document is making us think about what is science, what is physics. And when it uses the word physics, it doesn't really mean like describing things mechanically. It means physics as in what goes on in the world. The very, very simple definition that we started out with in the West thousands of years ago. And the way he uses science is the same way. It's talking about, you know, human knowledge. How do we come to know things? These days in science, there's often we have to question our assumptions and it's moving towards this radical skepticism that we really can't know much at all.
Right.
But yet, if we go through everyday life pretty secure in our knowledge of certain things, And so these documents, they approach science from a different kind of tack, saying that, you know, knowledge has to come through this sort of relationship between different parts of the universe.
And this one doesn't have a lot of history in it.
Right, because it uses a lot of these things that we've seen in the previous chapters of the book, like these really unusual looking scripts, or you know, just the idea that the document came out of a shrine or some ancient historical place. But the purpose of the document is not to talk about history. It really wants to talk about, I guess, metaphysics would be the right word for it. It's a very, like, you know, inspiring philosophical kind of document.
Okay. Now, one of the things you talk about this near the end of the book, you talk about the skeptics of these texts and what makes a text false and not. And you speak about the one example you give is the Gospels, and how they probably weren't written by the people who they're accredited to.
Right. Yeah. And I think people really, you know, they get kind of like, you know, maniacal about this. They're like, oh, you know, the Gospels couldn't have actually been written in like 30 AD when Jesus died. And that's not really the point. So.
Yeah.
And that's what I was trying to say about the documents I'm writing about, too, is that, yeah, it would be kind of hard to say that we really have records from millions of years ago about, you know, like spaceships flying around the world and world emperor and stuff like that. That's not really the point of why you would want to read this, and I don't really think it's why people who are interested in these documents read them, although they definitely are interested in the, you know, the unexplored and the unknown parts of history, and they definitely do look for like clues from around the ancient world. But it's also about, you know, what is the end message of that, and, you know, is there something important that you can bring back from reading these texts to the world around you. And I think, you know, we really need a paradigm shift with regard to how we think of alternative history like this.
Well, you also make the comparison at some point in the book to Castaneda's work, and I've seen enough evidence that Castaneda's work is probably fiction to some degree, but it doesn't make it less valuable. Like, I found a lot of valuable stuff from reading his work, even if it's fiction.
Exactly. It's really kind of, you know, it's surprising because when that book first came out, there were plenty of, like, you know, sociologists, because he's trying to write it as a work of sociology, and yet it turns into a very personal experience.
Yeah.
And there were sociologists who read it and said, wow, that is really powerful. That expresses the problem of trying to describe things objectively better than any of our, like, theoretical things could have done, because that was then and still is now a problem with these academic attempts to describe human things. And so it really is an important book in that way, even for academics. But then these days people just say, oh, no, it didn't actually happen, so it doesn't matter, which is, like, really not the point. And, yeah, people seem to be losing track of why people read stuff like this.
Yeah. You also point out that there's not a lot of motivation to spend the type of time to make these books. You mentioned MJ-12, but I think maybe the motivation for the MJ-12 papers was disinformation.
Yeah, I was checking up on that recently, and I realized I probably got that wrong. There were Air Force people who were definitely trying to misinform people in the 1980s about that. Yeah, regardless, it is a question of motivation. If you just play, oh, it's a forgery, it didn't happen. But that's not, you know, like, doesn't really answer the question of what the book is. Because why would you, like, for the Kujiki 72, for example, the first book we talked about, mm-hmm. that is, like, hundreds of pages of classical Chinese. Why would you spend so much time writing classical Chinese? Definitely not to make money off of it, I can tell you that. that would not work very well as a money-making plan.
It seems like you'd be undermining yourself just a little bit. I'm going to put all this work into this and have no way to really generate anything out of it.
Right. You know, the second book, it's a 10,000-line epic poem. And you think if someone was really wanted to like write poetry and get recognized and noticed by people, they wouldn't have like written it in like ancient Japanese and put it in an unreadable script, and then it just have to like translate it so that other people could read it. Like that is a really elaborate way to do that.
Yeah. There was something at the end of the book you write about called The Gray Gentleman, and I found this really interesting.
Yeah, there's a book by Michel Ende. This is the guy who wrote The Neverending Story, which is probably better known in America for the movie version.
Right.
But he also wrote a book called Momo, and that is a book that had a lot of influence on me. And it's about how like modern life values speed more than anything else. And in fact, people are so obsessed with doing things faster, they don't realize they're getting less and less done. So
I know how that feels.
Yeah, so right. and I tied that into parahistory in a maybe a kind of strained analogy, but it's about how like you need to focus on the qualities of things rather than just the quantities.
Right. And I thought that was really, really interesting. I didn't know he had other stuff like that. You had a couple of things in there about him at the end that were very interesting. You also deal with some other para-histories from around the world. So Japan's not the only place that has things like this.
Yeah, so in Japan is the place I wrote about because it caught my eye as a genre, and I was really only aware of just like, you know, scattered kind of unrelated things in the West. But when I started assembling stuff, I realized, you know, if I really want to make a list of what kind of books are similar to this in the West, there's probably going to be a lot of stuff I don't know about in there. And it was true. There's all sorts of amazing, like, you know, alternative history documents that have inspired people and, you know, inspired art and stuff like that. I include an example of artwork that came out of alternative like parahistory.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I feel like there's actually a lot to look at in English as well. I didn't even include everything in that last appendix there. There have been other documents that have come to my attention after publishing the book.
Well, I think it's interesting that you threw the Necronomicon in there, because I honestly think that there could come a point where people forget that that's fiction and think of it as an actual, you know, belief system at some point in our future.
Right.
Like, it's so ingrained in our culture, and it's so, you know, if people were trying to recreate stuff, they might see that stuff and think, oh, they believed in this god Cthulhu, and, you know, and not realize that it was all fictional.
Yeah, the whole Cthulhu story seems to be becoming more real as the years go on.
Yeah.
And people say, oh, yeah, Lovecraft is trying to pass it off as fiction, but actually he knew what's really going on.
Yep.
Something like that, right? And it's the same thing with the Necronomicon. Like, it came to him in a dream, so obviously it was a message from the elder gods, maybe.
Right,
but
right.
I don't know. It was like clearly a trope that he was using about the scary like book that has forbidden information in it, you know. Like,
but it would be interesting to see, you know, 1,000 years from now, if someone's digging up our culture and going, oh yeah, they believed in Shoggoths and Cthulhu and
yeah, for sure. But I put that in there because people have actually tried to publish what they claim to be a Necronomicon.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
There's been a few of them.
Totally ruins the horror part of the Lovecraft story.
Well,
when the guy is trying to decipher the ancient book, and someone else can be like, oh, yeah, I have that. It was published in 1970 by Mr. Simon.
Yeah, and the Simon version also, I mean, it's a very clear mix of, like, Sumerian and Lovecraft.
Yeah. I once flipped through that. I don't have a copy myself, but I was kind of befuddled a bit.
All right. There was one of the Kami legend. There was one other thing that really struck me as interesting. There's a legend of a rock cave. And I only took notes here, and I'm trying to remember exactly how this went, but there had something to do with thunderstones.
And I was wondering if you thought there was any connection maybe to ancient cataclysms from this legend.
Yeah, that's in the official history that this sword comes down from the sky and like lands on a rooftop and he says, yeah, this sword was sent down by the Kami. The ancient cataclysm theory, I don't think it quite matches up to that, but it leaks into this thunderstone mythology, which I think has been completely ignored by people who should be looking at it, like folklorists and historians. What's called thunderstones, we know them today as I've forgotten the word. Spearheads, right?
Those little stone
things for cutting or throwing spears that people find all over. And if anyone does know about the thunderstorm mythology, they're like, oh, those stupid medieval people didn't know what they were finding, and they thought the gods had sent down these stones. But that's not actually true. Thunderstones are actually known throughout the world. It wasn't just medieval Europeans. It was people who were living alongside hunter-gatherers and knew what arrowheads looked like. They were also said, when there's thunder, the gods send down these stones. So that's something I find pretty interesting, although I didn't have space to include that in the book at all.
But I wonder if that's like a memory of like a comet strike or meteor falls or something like that.
Yeah, I feel like it really, deserves a much closer look, because I know, for example, that there were legends like this in Japan, but I can't find anything about it at all. I was even trying to look through Japanese books, and I simply could not find any reference. Like, so maybe like one or two references to these medieval legends.
Hmm. All right. So what was the conference you just spoke at last week?
Yeah, so at Colgate University, that's Hamilton, New York, they had a conference on the esoteric, like old and new, east and west. They're covering everything from Kabbalah to Aleister Crowley and the left-hand path. And it was a very interesting assembly of people, I have to say.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
Yeah.
And you got to talk on what? Which manuscript?
I talked about the Hitsuki Shinji that I mentioned earlier.
The automatic writing.
Yeah, the automatic writing text.
Mm-hmm.
And how it sort of reflects there's a boom going on right now in Japan. More and more people are reading that text and looking into this esoteric world. And it seems to reflect a lot of concerns about the modern world and worries about like a global conspiracy and a future apocalypse. And I'm hoping I'll be able to investigate that more in Japan next year.
Hmm, okay. So are you working on anything else new, like book-wise?
Yeah, that's the topic I'm hoping to be able to research. It depends on the support of Japanese government and universities. And if there's one thing I learned at the esotericism conference is that esotericism is very marginal. You might call it esoteric.
Yes.
And there's not a lot of support even from other humanities departments that might want to, integrate it in.
Right.
And I think if you're wondering why people don't give much credibility to alternative histories and stuff like that, that might be part of the reasons. It simply is not, it is not considered something that you ought to be looking at if you're a professor or a student.
Okay. And where can people find you online?
Well, my website is avery.morrow.name. You can just Google my name. Avery Morrow, and you can find the research I've done so far on there or learn more about my book.
And I definitely recommend the book. It was published through Bear & Company, so it's available pretty much anywhere. And I very much look forward to what you're going to come up with next, because I think this is something that really does need to be brought out a little bit. It's definitely a hidden part of culture that hasn't really been explored.
Yeah, I hope I've got more exciting stuff coming up in the future.
All right. Well, I thank you for talking with us.
Yeah, thank you.
And again, that was Avery. This is what we're talking still with Avery Morrow. The book is The Sacred Science of Ancient Japan, Lost Chronicles of the Age of the Gods. And yeah, you should be able to find it anywhere. And one more time, your website?
Avery.morrow.name.
All right. Thank you. And Last Days of the Lost is up next, taking out with some Psyche Corporation, Whirring World.
Come in. Do you read me? Do you understand the numbers pouring over your connection?
To perfection.
5, 8, 3. Have you heard the singing soaking into our transmission?
21, 34, 55, 89, 144.
Number 1597 and counting.